and welcome to Joy of Cubing. I am your host, Matt Krantzstuber. This week, I am joined by special guest, Kenny Mayer. Kenny, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I usually do a big, long intro about, what I'm going to be talking about for the day, but this time I figured I'd just bring you right in because, you know, why let the audience sit there in anticipation?
All right, works for me.
Kenny, I wanted to have you on the show because you have been somebody who I've really kind of benchmarked as I've begun my, I'll call it cubing career. I use that in quotation marks. And, when I was spinning up my list the first time, you were somebody who was sort of a member on the Magic Salvation message boards. And you had a list a little bit larger than my list was. But anytime there would be like a card discussion or something that would come up, you would be sort of somebody who would be kind of like right in line with what I was thinking. And it was kind of cool because, you know, oftentimes I felt like I was kind of out in an island, especially when I first started posting, on forums and message boards and things, because my cube philosophy is maybe a little bit different. So it was kind of refreshing to have, you kind of come in and chime in on some cards that I'm just like, oh, wow, I never even thought to run those. Those are, you know, either unconventional or, you know, they were very good. Just people just didn't give them the respect that they deserve. So, I guess to start it off, maybe just a quick introduction of kind of who you are and you know, what kind of, like, maybe some basic cube stats, how big your cube is and how long you've been managing one.
All right. I've been playing Magic for roughly 10-ish years or so, and for about half that time, I've been playing cube. I got started many years ago after Anthony Avitola, posted something on like some Star City forum with photos of his cube, and I was like, what is this thing? This looks fantastic. let me give this thing a shot. Like, I have all these cards sitting around, they're not getting any play, like, why not just try it out?
Nice.
And yeah, I mean, it was awesome. And then shortly after that, Tom LaPille, he did something at Worlds in New York City like in 2007 or something like that, where they wanted to try to introduce cube to everybody, and like, so we had like 36 people that wanted to try cubing back then, and so we used his cube, Anthony's cube, and my cube, and we just got as many people as we could cubing that time, and it just really seemed to click with everybody was having a ton of fun, and who knew that like 5 years later, like this kind of niche format that hadn't really caught on just really kind of like blew up. Now it's on like Moto, and like everybody that, you know, plays it just comes to love it. It's
that's like something that we've seen sort of blossom over the last year and a half or so. Of course, you know, WotC has, you know, come out and said, hey, we're going to support this format. They've given it to us on Moto, which is amazing. But I think the channel Fireball guys, they just did a podcast talking about From the Vault Cube, and I don't think we're that far off from something like that. Given how much it seems like Wizards really likes Cube and developing for Cube.
I agree.
So, you know, hopefully, you know, someday, I don't care if it's a From the Vault set or even just like a little expansion pack with like maybe some custom cards that are just good in Cube. I would just freak out if a set like that came out. But certainly wouldn't be surprised.
The only problem with that kind of thing is like cards that are good in Cube have a very high probability of being good in Legacy as well.
That's true. Yeah, there's like the flow chart. Is it good in Limited? If yes, then go to next step. Is it good in Legacy? If yes, then it's probably good in Cube.
Exactly.
There are very few exceptions to that rule, like, you know, Arcbound Ravager. And and I built a whole cube just so that philosophy could not be that could be refuted.
Nice.
But so like I said, Kenny, I wanted to have you on the show. We have a few topics that I want to grind into tonight. The first one, of course, is, you know, depending on the size of your list, it really changes the way that you evaluate cards and really you evaluate your environment, right? So certain strategies, I think, are better as you're on the smaller end. And as your cube sort of grows in size, like as that the bell curve sort of draws itself out, those strategies fall in different places along that curve. And and part of the discussion is to talk about what kinds of strategies could you push at certain sizes, and, you know, what are the pitfalls to running smaller and larger lists. Of course, you being somebody who has had a ton of success running a larger list, you have a larger cube group, but you also sort of have other reasons for running that. And I want to kind of dig into that and kind of understand that. And then to sort of keep along with that topic, how do our card evaluations differ as that list gets larger? So we'll talk about that. And then following that, I'm going to start a new segment. I the other day on Twitter, I asked people if they could tell me a card that they thought was really off the wall that they wanted me to try. And so I'm going to talk about the cards that I actually took from those tweets, put them in my cube, and ran them, and what my experiences were. So I'm going to kind of run that. I'm calling it Dark Horse Theater. And then interspersed throughout this whole conversation, you are like, when I think of the deck Zoo, you know, a few people pop into my mind, you know, Pat Cox, Patrick Sullivan, and you. I mean, like, it's like when I think of red, green, white, and playing, like, you know, monsters, I think of Kenny Mayer. And that's not just in the cube sense. That's also, you know, you've had some success in Constructed and playing, you know, Tarmogoyf. You have obviously the famous Battle of Wits Zoo deck that, you know, if those listeners who haven't seen the clip of Kenny Mayer putting in a Battle of Wits off of his opponent's Show and Tell, it is quite a memorable moment. So I've taken up enough time with intro. Let's get right to it. So, Kenny, how big is your list right now?
It is currently 810 cards.
810. So has it always been 810 cards?
No, it's a pretty recent development that I expanded. I mean, recent being like a little less than a year now. For the longest time, I hovered at 720 for mm-hmm. the 2 8-man consecutive drafts without any repeating cards drafted. And then I was cutting cards that I felt like were still pretty good, and like I eventually expanded a little bit, but mostly it was just because like I just really enjoyed a lot of cards, and I thought they held up to power level standards. It wasn't really due to anything else besides that. But recently, like, our cube drafts has begun to really flourish around here, so I've been able to fire usually like a 10-man followed by an 8-man, so the size 8-10 works perfectly for that.
Sure. Though, yeah.
There is like a little wrinkle in that, and that is Booster Tutor. So it's sometimes you really have to keep track of packs made or cards drafted for Booster Tutor, because it can throw off the math of that completely. But it's fine. It works out in the end. It's cube night here, and we're pretty casual about it. It's all for fun.
Yeah. Yeah, Booster Tutor. For those of you who are listening to this and who have never played this card, it's an unhinged card. It costs 1 black mana. It's an instant. So we all know that 1 black mana instants are usually pretty good. This one, instead of searching your library, you're supposed to open a pack of cards. So, you know, it says like on the thing, are you man enough to open an Arabian Nights pack or something? But in the spirit of cube, you grab 15 cube cards. And then it's kind of like exciting. It's like playing the lottery. I actually had it in my draft deck last night.
It's amazing.
You're like, flip one over. No, that's not the one I want. Flip one over. And like a lot of times you're just like trying to find a land, you know, just like a dual land or a fetch land. And so it's like super fun. I don't think it's like overly powerful just because there's a lot of variance with it. Like you're not always going to find something that you need. But it's definitely got like probably as far as fun factor goes, it's got to be in the top 10 cards in the cube.
Yeah, I mean, if you're fine with playing unhinged cards and you like fun, you should definitely have Boosted Tutor inside of it. Like, it is well worth it. It's not overpowered. It's very flavorful, very fun. I think everybody that's not running it, you would get a kick out of it if you give it a shot.
Yeah. The only concern that I had, the only other time I didn't run it is when I had a fully pimped out cube. And when I took it to, like, events and stuff, I didn't like people digging through it. But I honestly, my cube's so low budget these days, as far as like, I don't put like a lot of big money cards in it. I proxy something if it's over $50. I don't care. So if I lose like a fetch land, you know, because it like fell on the floor, then, you know, whoops on me. But I haven't had a card stolen in years, so I'm not too worried about it. But, yeah. Okay. So your cube was 720. It ballooned up to 810. And, you know, by today's standards, 810's a little bit large, but 720 isn't really that big. My cube is about 620 right now, and I could easily add 100 cards to it without breaking a sweat. But, like, what was it like managing a big list, you know, 3 or 4 years ago? Like, let's say between Lorwyn and, you know, Shards. Like, what was it like trying to manage a list that was larger back then?
They've printed recently a lot of really good aggressive cards in the last, like, 5 years. So you really kind of had to scrape, you know, the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, with cards that barely make the cut in cubes. Like, so, like, the like when you would open a 15-card pack, like, usually the least exciting cards would be the aggressive cards. They'd still be functional, and the aggressive decks would do plenty of winning, but they wouldn't be that exciting. But now that's not really the case. Now you get all these Porcelain Legionnaires and Stormblood Berserkers and Arachnos Cacklers, and they're giving it to us, the support, to really make aggressive decks really function well in a larger cube list. Because beforehand, it was very easy to make, like, you know, the Signet into like a draw spell, into, you know, multiple removal spells followed by a finisher deck. Like, that's always been easy to assemble in a cube, especially in a giant size one like this. There's no shortage of mana rocks, no shortage of finishers, and really no shortage of card draw or card advantage 2-for-1s. But it was really making the aggressive decks fun to draft and, like, giving them incentives to be, you know, to go into.
Okay, so let me ask you this. What kind of sacrifices did you have to make? A term that you hear in the cube community is dragon cube. I actually think it's really an awful thing for people to call something a dragon cube. But to prevent your cube from being too mid-rangey, what kind of sacrifices did you have to make? Did you have to run, like, some pretty subpar cards, or did it feel like that when you were adding them?
I mean, it felt a little awkward. Like, you just have to maintain, like, a reasonable curve, basically. Like, you know, if you lay out your cube similar to, like, a limited deck, you wouldn't want your limited deck to be bottlenecked up at 5, 6, 7, you know? And it's similarly the same thing when you're laying out your cube list. You want your plays to come at, you know, a bunch of reasonable amount of ones, but heavy on, like, 2s and 3s, and 4 is the hot spot of Magic, has been for as long as I can remember. They just keep printing just fantastic cards there. Like, you want to make sure that your cube is, basically like a curve of a limited deck.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. And, you know, when I do big cube updates, it's exactly what I do. You know, I start by color, and then by card function. And then, you know, creatures obviously are sort of the biggest pile of anything. And so if you're looking at red, you know, you've got, you know, Grim Lavamancer, Magus of the whatever, and, you know, kind of like look at all your 1-drops, 2-drops, 3-drops. And then, you know, if you want to sort of gear up a color, you know, like, okay, my red's not aggressive enough. You know, the only red decks that we've seen lately have been, you know, these dumb Wildfire decks or something. Then you could pretty easily sort of like retool your section. Like, well, I can see, like, in the 3 and 4 section, we're pretty heavy, but we only have, you know, 8 1-drops or something. And this is where I think the importance of maintaining, like, a really organized on-deck system will really help you to fill that out a lot easier. So do you have anything like that? Like, do you have, like, a binder or, like, a spreadsheet that you have? I mean, I'm looking at your cube list right now, where you have some of those cards in there that you maybe have cut in the past or that you want to put in your cube?
I do, actually. I have the binder is always bursting at the seams. I have to purge it of cards, like, every, like, year or two that are just, like, they're just not even consideration anymore. Like, and because there's always cards that I'm interested in. I'm always checking people's lists. Yours is one of the top ones that I love checking for just really interesting ideas. And, like, there's so much potential, even with 810 cards, I just never have enough to play with. Like, I was just trying to figure out recently, I had read Parnell, he had said really good things about Master Biomancer, and I had, like, just kind of, like, looked at the card, and I've been like, it has potential, but it's a 4-drop, and it's in blue-green, but then, like, I've heard a bunch of really positive feedback from people that I respect, so I'm gonna give it a shot. I haven't gotten to actually play it in a draft yet, it's a very recent edition, but I'm very excited about it, and that's the same thing with a great number of cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, I was going to say, like, your article mentioning Legion Loyalist, I had written that card off, and then you gave it a really positive reaction, and it's turned out great so far. I've been very impressed, and, like, I mean, there's just so many Magic cards.
I know. I actually, I've always had, like, this little 360-card monster binder, and I recently got to the point where I was, like, sticking cards, like, sideways in it because I couldn't fit any more in the binder, so I just bought a second binder, and so I'm actually halfway through another 360 card binder, so I actually have enough cards here to make a cube with an on-deck binder. I mean, that's insane, because before it was like only, you know, 4 or 5 pages worth, and now it's like anytime I think of something off the wall or someone mentions a card and they're like, hey, you should play, I'm looking at one right now. You should play Orcish Oriflame as it was originally printed in Alpha at Red 1.
And I mean, like, that card's nice.
That card's really good. And like, I'm surprised Anthony Avitolo isn't running it, since like he's like totally the guy that he loves classic stuff. He doesn't mind sort of, you know, bending the rules a little bit in the sake of having a good time.
And, two Moloku tokens?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So he has a Spanish Molokus. That make tutus. That's just that's kind of what Moloko needs these days, honestly. I don't think that card is very good.
I agree with you. It's not one of, it gets picked, it's like a 12th, 13th pick around here a lot of times, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Like it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's just it didn't stand the test of time. But okay, so managing a large list, you know, we talked about the way that you have to sort of craft your environment around, you know, for you, your mission statement is, I want to be able to have an aggressive queue but still be large enough to support multiple pods of people. And I think that's really admirable. That's kind of where I'm at. I started relatively small. I think my cube was like in the 440 range, but that was just because I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my list. And then it kept ballooning, and then it was like 540. And now like I'm sort of hovering in the 600 range, and I like that spot. It lets me do two side by side eight mans, like not, I shouldn't say two side by side. I could do an eight man and a six man.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Mm-hmm. But if we do two six mans in a row, we can see all the new cards. And I think that's like one of the best things about running a large list. And I didn't really understand this fully until I did like a bunch of moto cubing just back to back to back to back, which is, it just adds so much more to the second draft. Like, you're just not like, when I draft a 360 card list, you know, you're gonna see the same cards over and over and over again. You know, a 540 list, you know, it's gonna be half as frequent, but like when you double that size, like it's pretty great. I mean, I think that it just adds a lot of variety. I don't know. Do you feel like when you draft smaller lists, does it change your draft mentality?
Do you mean like if I'm drafting like a smaller list, but I'm planning on for sure doing like two drafts in a row? Is that
no? Like, okay, so let's say that you're drafting a small list. You open pack one, pick one, Sulfuric Vortex. Does the way that you draft change in a 360 card list versus a 600 card list?
I mean, there are definitely cards that you value higher the smaller the cube is. Basically, those based on small like or strong synergies and combos that you know will have. They're in the cube. They exist in the draft. As long as nobody else steps on your toes, you will be able to assemble them. While in a larger cube list, you know, sometimes like there's a great amount of redundancy based, but sometimes they just don't show up. Sometimes you don't have the tinker, or sometimes the sneak attack wasn't in the draft, or the recurring nightmare wasn't in the draft. So you have to kind of adapt on the fly.
Yeah. Those are good examples. Sneak attack, tinker, Stoneforge Mystic. The smaller your cube, like those cards are intrinsically very powerful cards, but they get better when those interactions are closer together, right? So if I'm in a 360 card draft with eight people and I open a Batterskull, or actually I should say if I open a Stoneforge Mystic, I have a fairly good chance of seeing, having a chance to see the Batterskull and or like another powerful piece of equipment. Like, I'm probably not going to see a Jit realistically, but I'll probably see a Sword of Worm piece or, you know, a Grafted War Gear.
Yeah, you'll get something. It's very, very likely you'll either open it or you'll have a controlling or high end mid range opponent to your right or left, and you'll get like 2 to 3 packs deep before anybody else would take a equipment. So yeah, your Stoneforge is super powerful in a smaller list. Like, it's still very good in a larger list, but it's more of like a cross your fingers. Sometimes every once in a while it'll blank on you. But
yeah, okay, so. I'll give a couple more examples of these kinds of cards, but then I got to ask about supporting some of the more modular strategies. So, okay, just a couple cards that I think sometimes are misevaluated are cards like Sun Titan, where, you know, again, Sun Titan is a very powerful card. So, like, the mentality, I think, is the more powerful the card, the more likely it is to be included in a smaller list. Or in a larger list, and then like sort of as you comb it down, like the 360 should just be like the most powerful cards you could run. And sometimes I think it's like the opposite, right? So not today, because we have like a bunch more swords, you know, like we have Sword of Feast and Famine, War and Peace, etc. But like Stoneforge Mystic realistically like wasn't as good an inclusion in a larger list. You know, if we go back, like right when Worldbreak was released, just people that weren't including it at all.
I was one of them. I didn't add it for a little while. I might have been wrong, but I eventually got on board. Probably around the time that Blue Green Sword was spoiled in the From the Vaults thing. It might have been a little before that. I can't recall exactly, but it definitely spent some time not in my cube.
Yeah. So you know, though, that's where I think you have to be very. You have to be very environment conscious when you look at evaluating a card, you know. So like Smash to Smithereens has like a similar effect, right? So like at the 360 level, you could probably reliably kill something very powerful with that card. But as you sort of dilute the card effects across another 500-ish cards, your targets are going to be less numerous and less impactful, I think. Is that a fair assessment?
I agree, though I do think Smash Smithereens is fantastic. So.
No, Smash is a good card. I've kind of been wary about including cards like Smash that are fairly narrow for mono red. Mono red is the only color that I give special treatment to, just because I think it has so many cards that are mono red only. Go ahead.
I can agree with that. I mean, I try to limit it to a certain extent, but I'm not going to lie. I probably am a little too heavily skewed. Mono red is the best deck in my cube still. Like, I try to keep everything else in check, but if, you know, gloves are off and cutthroat and you're trying to win, say, you know, you had anything on the line, you would probably draft mono red.
red is kind of like on and off for our list. We got a couple guys that love to draft red. I'll draft red if I open a Vortex or a Koth or something that just makes me feel like I should go into red. But usually when I play red, I like to pair it with like more trickier color combinations. So I really like red green, but not red green aggro.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is pretty awesome. Actually, one subject I really want to talk about is the just red green as an archetype and how it's sort of, I mean, it basically fell off the map. Like, red green cards just like were not good enough anymore. Maybe let's just dig into that now. So like, okay, for me, I'm looking at my on deck binder and I'll just be totally forthright and honest. The first card that stares at me every time I open it is Curdape.
Oh my God.
It's on the front page. It's there on purpose. One of my favorite cards of all time, and it just didn't get played, and I guess maybe I'll just ask you. So do you feel like red green aggro has been draftable in your list? Like you sort of winced when I said that, so I'm assuming that you like Curdape a lot and shouldn't be cut.
I mean, it was in jest. I mean, I definitely understand like sometimes like green doesn't add a ton to aggressive strategies other than some reasonably efficient beaters, but not a lot of tricks, disruption, or power cards, like aka like Vortex or Stoneforge or anything like that.
Mm.
But at the same time, it provides like a backbone of like the really, really good, like the one drops, like the Curd Apes, the Lone Wine, the Wild Nacatls. Like it, unfortunately, it also presses you into playing some things like Jungle Lion and below. Like Jungle Lion's fine, but like say like Wild Dogs or something like that, mm-hmm. which were, I got verbally berated many times for many years for trying to force the Wild Dog deck, but eventually conceded and it is no longer my cube.
Did you ever play a Fetch Land into Wild Dogs?
I have not done that. I cannot say I've done that.
I have actually done that before, so.
I've done some other really, really dumb things before, though. So.
Nice. Okay, so, you know, for me, I red-green sort of fell out of favor the day that I had to cut Stormbind. And I know Stormbind's more of a mid-range card than it is really an aggro card. But it made me realize that I just didn't like red-green. Like, I didn't like the section. You know, realistically, I have my list up. In my red-green section, Bloodbraid Elf has always been sort of at the top of the list as being, you know, the default red-green card. Huntmaster of the Fells is the second one. But until Gatecrash, those are the only two red-green cards I had in my queue. And that includes Curd Ape. With Gatecrash, and I was very hopeful that this would happen, we got a couple cards that I think are going to put Red Green back on the map to the point where I think Mr. Curd Ape is going to be able to come back. And those cards are Domirad, which is, you know, a Red Green Planeswalker that's very powerful and, very unassuming. And then Ghoul Clan Smasher, which is potentially one of the best Red Green cards ever printed.
The Rampager?
Yes. Oh, I don't know if I said it right. Yeah, Rampager.
All right.
So, I mean, are you running those guys in your list?
Yeah, they're both really, really sweet. I love Domirad. I picked up a set for Constructed. Like I actually bought cards. I try not to buy that many singles anymore. But I was like, this guy, he seems fantastic. He's a 3-mana Planeswalker in green, the color of mana elves. Like, he does. He just seems awesome. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
plus the art's sweet.
Yeah, the art's awesome. The art's super awesome. It reminds me of Mirage. Like, just the, I don't know. He feels like he planeswalked from the Mirage plane. The reason that I like those cards is it's kind of made me relook at Curd Ape. I added Flint Hoof Boar back, because I want to just see, you know, what it's like. I put Burning Tree Emissary in. So I kind of put all these cards in to see, okay, if I just bombard my drafters with red green, will they realize that red green is a good archetype again? Because they didn't believe. Like every time I wanted to add Curd Ape back, like we'd sit there and debate, and it's just like, put some other one drop in, like put, you know, Mog Fanatic. You know, it's just anything but Curd Ape. I don't want a 1/1. So, I don't know. Like, do you have any suggestions for me, like to kind of help out to push that red green deck? Because I'm honestly it's a gap in my cube design that I can't quite figure out.
Well, I have a not quite balanced gold. So like red green is like I cheat on color sections. So red green is like reasonably heavily supported in my cube. I have like all of those cards mentioned except for the emissary, which as an aside, I'd love to hear your impressions of it in a second. But, like, I mean, I have, like, Curd Ape, Flint Hoof, for, like, a lot of other cards that try to push the deck together. The problem is, like, my issue with it a lot of times is at three. The problem with red and green a lot of times is, like, green, like, the a lot of the solid two-drops that aren't just, like, value guys like the Viridian Shamans and Orangutans have double green in their cost. Mm-hmm. And then like the really good red beaters that aren't just value guys like Keldon Vandals and like Fire Imp also have double red in their cost. So like, I mean, it's not that unreasonable to get a dual land to be able to play either one of those, but I find like it makes for like an awkward looking pool when you lay it out a lot of times when you draft the red green decks. Like, it's not something that's, you know, apparent at first, but it's one of those things that after drafting the deck a lot of times, it's something that gets at me, and I really wish Wizards would print more splashable guys of that nature. It's kind of why, like, the Burning Tree Shaman, like, he's a reasonable guy, but he's a good aggressive card, and I wish there was more cards of that nature that existed.
Yeah. Well, something that I noticed that you've done is, well, I want to talk about how you've doubled up on a couple cycles. But before that, you have the M10 cycle, which is a cycle that I've been experimenting with, just adding a few copies where I thought it would be good. The Glacial Fortress and Dragon Skull Summit, those cards. So it seems like that would be a pretty good cycle to have to support, you know, multiple colors. And then you also have Firelit Thicket. Now, I've been running all of the black-based filter lands because I need black mana to be able to support cards like Necropotence and Xur'alf's Messenger outside of Mono Black. And they've been fantastic to the point where, like, I'm almost convinced that just all 10 of them are good enough. So you run all 10.
They're very good. They're not really highly praised. They're just, and a lot of cubes that are smaller than mine often can't find the space. So that might be the incorrect terminology. They just choose not to run them over other options because there are plenty of options. But I think they are very powerful lands that still see play in Modern. Like they do a lot of work for your mana base. And like we were talking about, like how the three drops, like a Firelit Thicket, everything's good. You're fine for probably the rest of the game. The only awkward thing is if you have it on turn one and that's your only source of one of the two colors, you're a little miffed, a little awkward, but for the most part, it does some work, and I'm happy to have them.
Yeah, so, of course, mana fixing is really important as your cube gets larger. Because, you know, it's pretty easy to go around and find, you know, one, two, three drops in a color. It's easy to find blue counter spells. It's easy to find mana rocks. Like, Wizards has printed enough of these effects over the years that, you know, there are a plethora of substitutes out there for you to choose from. That's why this on-deck binder is so big. You know, most of these are interchangeable. Some of them may never see the light of day again. But what there aren't a lot of substitutes for is good land, you know. So once you kind of tap into the fast lands, the M10/Innistrad lands, filter lands, and then of course, you know, the dual lands, fetch lands, shock lands, and then some people still run some bounce lands. I still run two bounce lands in my cube. You're kind of like out of options, right? Wizards can only print so many dual land cycles through the years, and they've been very careful to not print any. I mean, the last dual land cycle we got was Mirrodin, and then before that, it was Worldwake with the man lands.
Was Mirrodin the M10 ish land where they finished the cycle? I think it was Innistrad had the second half.
Yeah, Innistrad. Yeah, you're right. So we had the enemy lands. I guess it looks like maybe every year and a half or so we get like a reasonable cycle. And of course, with Shocklands in Standard and Innistrad lands, I don't know that I would be expecting to see any like super off the wall dual land cycles in M13 or M14 and or the fall set. But anyway, So anyway, I digress here. So you have done something that I've seen mentioned. First of all, you're the first person that I saw suggest it, and you suggested on the forums, which is to add a second cycle of cards, being the Shocklands and Fetchlands. So explain like your logic here and sort of like what that's done for your cube.
As you were mentioning a little earlier about how like there's a lot of cards that are kind of interchangeable, like all the drops, like granted there are some dips in power level or function, but for the most part you can make a cube with just a bunch of different cards and it'll still play out well. But as you also mentioned, the lands, you don't have a lot to choose from, and it really determines how games play out based on the quality of your mana base. And like, I wanted to make sure that the aggressive decks really weren't hurt by having me forcing like the bounce land cycle to remain in the cube, like, because I never want to touch one of those when I'm an aggressive deck. And I love a bounce land, but yeah, like, but because I had those in for so long, I felt like control or mid-range decks had an extra, you know, they had an extra shot at fixing that the aggressive strategies didn't. And the aggressive strategies often need it even more than those decks do, because they, if you can't cast your turn one into turn two drop a lot of times, and you have to do it turn two to turn three, or, you know, you stumble a little longer than that even, like, you're just going to lose the game because your game plan is often based solely around tempo. And I wanted to make sure, like, a really good cycle of lands, basically more fetches and more duels, was available at a cube of my size.
Sure. So was your group and people that I've drafted with, are they pretty receptive to the idea?
Yeah, like, at first I definitely got heckled a little bit, you know, they're like, oh, slippery slope, but, they've definitely come around, you know, nothing, you know, sometimes they'll be like, oh, I have two scalding tarns in my pack or something like that, but, you know, it's, for the most part worked out very well, and I think the decks have noticeably improved, across the board, but especially aggressive strategies, I think, have gotten the most out of this.
Sure. So, and this is something that has kind of come into the limelight recently. Jason Weddell wrote something over on Channel Fireball about this, and it kind of brought up this whole discussion of, okay, well, you know, what really is within the confines of, like, cubing? Like, you know, you're really creating a custom draft format. You know, why is adding a second cycle of lands any different than, you know, including unhinged cards, or, you know, which are never meant to see any tournament or competitive play. And I would say cube is a competitive casual format. I mean, people are, you know, you're playing to win. You're not, you know, you're playing to have fun, but I think it's, I don't know how to say it without being disingenuous to you know, other people that are playing for the format. But for me, I'm like a pretty spiky guy. So when I sit down, like, I want to draft, like, the best possible deck, but also have, like, a good time. But I want to smash my opponents. Like, I want to win every game of Magic I play.
I agree. Like, if I see a Cruel Ultimatum, I will windmill slam that thing, even though it's not correct, because I want to have fun. But from there, I'm going to try to draft the actual best Cruel Ultimatum deck I can do.
Like, so I think that's some good wisdom there. So, and I might subscribe to this. Your first pick is your fun pick. And then every pick after that is to build the best possible deck you can.
I mean, that's not always the case. Like, it's a good chance I could, you know, table, like, for example, that Cruel Ultimatum. But, you know, I really want to have it. I really want to build around it, you know. So,
yeah.
Like, I want to have fun in the draft. But like you were also saying, you and me, I think we're both, we're out to win it. But,
yeah, I mean, so we want, especially if you have, like, a nemesis in your group. So you have guys every week that, like, you know, just always seem to smash you. And so you just got to get them this week. And like, I've gotten to a point where I'll, even if I have, like, a rivalry, I'll just make them the captain. Like, when we're doing teams, I'm assuming you probably do mostly team drafts, right?
We do solely team drafts. I don't think I have done a single person cube draft here in, I can't remember how many years.
Yeah. We did, like, one Swiss draft one time. I maybe a little bit more than that. With, like, when you have, like, the random five people and it's, like, kind of an odd number. But it's pretty much 99% of the time team drafts. And I think, like, team drafts add so much to the draft format.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the idea of running an extra cycle of cards, or you know, or having a pack where you get a, you know, if you draft one Squadron Hawk, you get three, or if you get a Nissa, you get Nissa's Chosens, or something I would love to see is Urza lands. Like, I just think that would be so cool if you drafted, you know, Urza's tower, you got three lands, but you, like, randomly put them throughout. But that seems like more like a custom draft set more than it is cubing. I don't know.
It's like what the people I cube with, like, it's kind of like what they're saying, like, slippery slope kind of thing. I told them, like, I was not going to, like, I was going to do my best not to go beyond this land cycle thing. I'm only doing this for the function of the cube because, like, I think a good mana base is at the very heart of having a good experience with the cube. But, like, most of the other stuff is relatively, like, you know, air quotes, interchangeable, like we were mentioning.
Sure. Yeah, that's That's a good outlook, I think. And to me, I don't, slippery slope or not, I have a good time, you know, regardless, as long as someone puts the thought into it, you know, that's fun. I would prefer not to play with like double sets of power or something, but,
I mean, right. Well, I do it once. I mean,
I'd try anything once. Yeah, sure. So let's transition over a little bit. You know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, how you evaluate cards as lists get larger. Do you have, like, let's get into like sort of the dark horse discussion. Do you have any cards that play out just like incredibly well in your list that you think other players either are underdrafting, you know, like in other communities, or just don't quite understand how they work? Do you have anything like that?
I possibly do. But a lot of cards have really, that I was hyping for a while, have kind of come into their own acceptance wise. I feel like Craterhoof Behemoth is really starting to catch on. I think that guy is unbelievable.
he may be Green's best finisher.
He's so good. I discussions on forums. Like, I can't really point out why. I know he can't be cheated into play. I know he doesn't work well with like non-creature, you know, mana, so to speak. But like he just works.
That's a fair statement that he works. He's tricky. Like, you know, he's not like over the top powerful like a card like Woodfall Primus, where you're just like, you know, cheat Woodfall Primus into play or Natural Order or whatever, and Woodfall Primus comes in and just like, okay, do you have a swords? Because if not, you're pretty much dead. I'm just gonna, you know, seal the game. Behemoth is like, you gotta finesse it. You gotta set up the turn where you've got, you know, guys on the board and you're gonna behemoth them to death, or like even just playing a behemoth until like an okay board, but maybe you have a Restoration Angel or something. Like just getting like that extra bit of value.
To like 12 damage out of nowhere.
Yeah. And that's like, I think what really makes him better than some of the other finishers like Terracidon, or even like a guy that I never thought I would cut, Cross and Tusker. Just like, it's just so boring. That card just, to me, I don't like that card. And I think it deters people from playing drafting otherwise good cards. Like, you know, some of the newer cards like Experiment One or, you know, some like the more aggro oriented guys.
I agree. I Crows and Tusker is in and out of my list more than most cards. I respect it for, you know, its flexibility, but it is just never that exciting at any mode it's chosen to be played at. So,
and it's like, do you really need like a 3-mana uncounterable instant divination? Like, is that really what Green wants? Like, would you play that if it was just divination? Like, maybe, like, I guess that's pretty good. I play Harmonize. I like that, but I think that's much better than Cross and Tusker. I don't know.
I agree, but the potential to draw you two gas spells, you know, is I would play a Green Divination over Cross and Tusker. I believe, like, having one of your cards, 50% of the cards drawn, be a basic land, I think hinders it. And I understand the 6/5 later in the game is, you know, reasonable upside, but at the same time, a 6/5 no evasive 7-drop is not usually, it's not that exciting. It's funny, you know what I'm talking about.
Funny enough, the last time I had that card resolved against me was just after you had sent me a Facebook message. This was like last summer or something. You're like, hey, you should add Maelstrom Wanderer because the card's insane. And and I'm like, Maelstrom Wanderer, what the hell is that? I'm like, that's not in any set. What is that from? And it was it's a Plane Chase card that had just come out or whatever. It's 8-mana, red, green, blue, 5 with double cascade. And my opponent proceeded to cascade into that plus like some random 3-drop and attack me for lethal. I'm like,
Well, then Crows and Tusker with haste is a little different than just regular Crows and Tusker.
Yeah, when he's a Rorix without flying, that definitely gives him an edge. So, I kind of like I said, you know, when I started posting on the forums, and I still post on Magic forums, and, you know, we obviously communicate via Facebook and Twitter and all these other places that you can find Cube content. You're somebody that you're kind of the first person that I would go to with some wild off the wall suggestion. But this week I went to Twitter and I asked, I said, you know, what are like the craziest possible cards that I could add to my list? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick three people out who had said to add a particular card, and then that I added it and what my experiences were. So if you don't mind, I'm going to pull those up here real quick. So the top of the list is Usman. Of course, we love Usman. He's our bro. And,
great guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Listen to his podcast. It's great. Third Power. Okay. So he says Rune Chanter's Pike, and, he said some other cards, but, Rune Chanter's Pike was at the top of the list, and that kind of like popped out at me. I'm like, ah, okay. So it's two mana artifact equipment. When you equip it, your guy gets first strike and then gets pumped plus the number of instants you have. And I kind of like run this small instance matters theme. So this one kind of like hit with me. I don't want to add anything that's like so off the wall that it doesn't make sense, right? So if I'm not pushing goblins, I'm not going to add Goblin War Chief, right?
Makes sense.
That example. So, okay, so I added that one. The next suggestion that I had was to add Icarid. That was by the Cube Miser, Brian Miller, and I did end up adding that. Unfortunately, that did not get drafted, but I will talk about my thoughts on that. The last card that was suggested to me was Cabal Therapy by Jason Waddell, and so I'm gonna dig into those three and why I added them. So, if someone told you to add Rune Chanter's Pike, is that like a card that's on your radar at all?
I mean, I had thought about it, but I had never gone beyond thinking about it. The thing that attracts me the most is it's efficiently costed, unlike most modern equipment, and the effect is pretty powerful. But I'm interested to hear exactly how it turned out for you.
Okay, so we didn't see it in our we had a 10-person draft. Yeah, we had 10 people. We did not see it in that draft, which is like really unfortunate. I thought every card I added would see play in the draft, but it did see play in a grid draft after, and it was in a red blue. It was like mostly mono red, except it splashed for like Compulsive Research and like maybe Factor Fiction, and then it had like some red blue dual lands.
Okay.
So it was like really well set up to be able to handle this. It had like, you know, a pretty reasonable curve. I think it had like 13, 14 creatures. And then the rest was just like all burn. So like to me, like that looked really exciting because, you know, it was going to make the small guys, you know, so like the Mog Fanatic type, you know, stat creatures get really big later in the game and then just be able to present like really difficult combat because like the first strike. So
yeah, it's huge.
I wish I got to see play, but I watched him build his deck. This was like real late, you know, right before I had to cut the draft short. But I mean, it was perfect in his deck. Like the only other equipment, you know, that I would have played would have been swords, you know, or Jit. But I honestly don't even know that that like a sword, like tempo wise, would have been good in the list. Like I feel like that was like just perfectly positioned in the two slots. So. But yeah, that was pretty cool. So then, you know, of course, the second suggestion was to play by Brian Miller to play Icarid. And that one did not see play, unfortunately, because of the draft contents. It just didn't. No one saw it in the draft. But the idea there was that, you know, along with the cards that I recently added, like Stinkweed Imp, to be able to get a bunch of guys in the yard, to get guys like Resembling Skeleton, you know, back into play, Bloodghast, that you should be able to like reliably dump enough, you know, like non-recurring guys in the yard to be able to recur Icarid, and mm-hmm. It's fairly aggressive. So like I kind of liked that its ability to just come in and, you know, do its thing, but you really have to be oriented toward the graveyard. I feel like that one might be like a little off the top. What do you think?
It seems very difficult for that one to get to work. I don't really have necessarily a pox package, or so I don't have like the recurring skeleton in my list, so to speak. Yeah, I mean, a 3/1 non-evasive kind of attacker seems I don't know. I could be wrong. Like, he's very difficult to evaluate kind of card. I think maybe if he sees some play in the next draft, I'd be interested in hearing. But my initial opinion of it, I guess, is it might just be a little too out there.
Yeah, I think if it stuck around, I think that definitely gives it a little bit of a reach. But even then, it's like, well, so what's it going to do? Once it dies, you can bring it back. I think you have to be pushing a Graveyard's Matter, cube to the point where, like, I don't even know that you could put that many black creatures in the yard to make it something that makes it worthwhile. So, it's going to stay on my radar as long as I continue to kind of, like, explore graveyard strategies, but it was kind of a dud. But where there are two, one I would say is not a dud. I'm very excited to try Pike out more. There's one that Jason's suggestion of Cabal Therapy. This card, unfortunately, I guess I'm kind of copping out here because I have added this a few weeks ago. And this card is probably my favorite black discard spell in the cube at the moment.
That's strong words. I'm interested to hear how it's been, playing out.
Well, okay, so I added the Pox package is really just a recursive creature package. So, you have the Nether Spirits and Resembling Skeleton, Bloodghast, and all these guys that sort of like get value on coming back from the graveyard. And then, just having guys that you can kind of like toss under the bus in order to force through a big play, I think is what really gives Cabal Therapy like some real meat. So I had it in my deck in Cube Night this week, and my deck was Blue-Black Temple. My first pick was a Duskmantle Seer, and my second pick was a Gravecrawler, and then my third pick was a Miscalculation, and then the deck just wrote itself. And so my deck was really, really powerful. I had really good disruption, and to give you an idea of how good Cabal Therapy was, Cabal Therapy was in my main deck, and Duress is in my sideboard.
All right.
So I'll give you some use case scenarios. So, Duress always hits the card that you want it to hit. But if you have information on what your opponent's playing, either, they played a card that made them reveal a card, or they're playing, usually it's if you've like Chitaxian Probe or Thoughtseize, you kind of get that info already. Or if you're in game two and game three, like, you know what cards are problematic. So your opponent plays like really weird magic, right? So maybe he's like has two islands, two other lands, and a Caracas. Well, there's a pretty good chance that he has been sandbagging the Venser that really wrecked you in the first game. So that's exactly what I did. I'm just like, tap black, Cabal Therapy, name Venser. And it's just like, Venser hits the bin. And that ended up taking the game. And then being able to flash it back in a pinch, if you get two cards, like, that's great, but you're probably just going to get one card. I think that's more than enough. I don't know. And then, like, as Sam Black said, like, being able to sacrifice guys is one of the most powerful effects in Magic, and I'm inclined to agree with that.
All right.
So I don't know. I don't know. Am I convincing enough? You thinking about trying it out?
I'll try it out. I'll try most things. So I've room to play with.
So, yeah, I think those are all good suggestions. There were a lot of, like, I put every single card that were in those posts in my on-deck binder, and I'm going to go back through and favorite all of them. So I'm going to do this again next episode, and I'll make sure that the cards are in the draft. It was just so, like, there were so many people, we were trying to put packs together that I didn't think to, like, make sure that the cards are actually in the draft. So that was, like, my blunder for a first time around, but, what are you going to do? But okay, so Kenny, I've kind of like talked about everything I wanted to from, a large cube perspective. Do you have like any additional thoughts or anything that you wanted to dig into on the show, or any questions like about my list or anything random?
I don't have any questions prepared necessarily off the top, but I just would like to, not necessarily a question, but say that I think your cube list is one of the best, and while I haven't gotten to sit down and draft it in a long time, I would love to at some point again in the future, because, it's really well put together. It's a nice, it's not quite as large as mine, so the power level is a little bit higher, but it's still large enough to provide a lot of variety, and, like, I really enjoy that about cube lists, especially, like, you you think out the construction of it, and you have certain themes and payoffs for going certain directions, not just about like having like the highest power level, because oftentimes, like, if you decrease the power level a little bit in certain spots, it makes the overall, your overall deck a lot better because of synergies. And I really, really like how that's constructed.
So, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Okay. So are you going to be at any events coming up? Like if, you know, like, are you going to be at Grand Prix Pittsburgh or,
I don't think I'm going to make Pittsburgh, sadly. I mean, I definitely am going to be at some events, but I don't know if I'm going to be making it out to anything Midwest for a little bit.
Bummer. So, okay, so if people want to read anything that you have going on, or any articles or Twitter, I mean, what do you got going on so that people could kind of follow up on what you're doing?
I have a Twitter account that I post on occasionally. I'm going to be trying to be more active in that respect. My handle on there is Mayor of Averbrook, spelled the same way as the card. And most of my talk on there is about Cube, and like, especially when new sets come around, which is going to be in a couple of weeks. There's lots of discussion on there every time like a reasonable Cube potential card comes out, and I'm very excited to talking about it with other people like you and Parnell and Usman and Anthony and like everybody else. And yeah, there's tons of resources available for Cube, and hopefully I can put forth a little bit more content on my own.
Just having your list around, and I mean this with the utmost sincerity. If listeners are managing a list in that size range, so from 700 to 900 cards, like you have to look at Kenny's list. You absolutely are doing yourself a disservice to not benchmark it, because it's like. If you're making a cola and not drinking Coke and Pepsi, like that's how offensive it is to not look at this list. So, like I said, I've been benchmarking for a long time. I appreciate you coming on the show, man. It's been a blast. I really hope that maybe this summer, maybe at Gen Con or something, we can do just nonstop Cube drafts. That's like my dream. I always set those days aside.
Oh man, that would be fantastic. We'll see what the job situation is looking like at that moment in time, because I would love to come to Gen Con some year.
Got to do it, man. It's like it's becoming a reunion tour, reunion tour of all the awesome players, and it's just for me. Like last year, I didn't play. I walked the dealer hall a few times, and then it was just like, okay, let's play Glenn Jones's one drop cube. Let's go play Usman's cube. Let's play my cube. Let's play combo cube. And it was just like nothing but cube for 4 days. It was insane.
That sounds amazing.
But okay, so you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at KaseDube. You can follow the show at Joy of Cubing. And of course, Kenny is on Twitter at Mayor of Averbrook. And you can check out any articles that I have will be posted on StarCityGames.com. And a huge shout out to Adam and Gathering Magic for hosting the podcast. We certainly appreciate that. And huge thanks to all the listeners, all the feedback that you guys give. It's absolutely amazing to see you. You guys have helped me sort of build this and make it a brand that's a lot of fun to come back to. We got a lot of good stuff to talk about. And but Kenny, thanks so much again, man. I really appreciate it. And hope you have a great spring.
Well, you too, and hopefully I run into you, sooner rather than later. And thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, man. Anytime. And until next time, we are Jor Cubing. Thanks for listening.